Well, for the past several weeks, we've been going through a series on the identity of Providence Church. And in the past two of those Sundays, we've spoken about being Christ-centered, and we've talked about gathering to meet with God on His day. Today, I would like to take up the subject that both gives us the right to meet with God, it gives us access to Him, as well as the subject that shows us most clearly the glory of Christ. We talked about we must see Christ and find Him beautiful to be changed. And it is this subject that most expressly shows us His glory. In 1525, Martin Luther preached a sermon concerning God's own sermons. Luther looked at the scripture and he said, you know, there are two very obvious public sermons preached by God. One at Mount Sinai and another on the day of Pentecost. He said, they're two sermons and they're two totally different ways of approach. There's something distinctly different about each mode of these sermons. They're both wholly true, but they're different messages. He goes on to say, now the first sermon and doctrine is the law of God, and the second is the gospel. These two sermons are not the same, and therefore we must have a good grasp of the matter in order to know how to differentiate between them. We must know what the law is and what the gospel is. You see, these two different sermons, as Luther calls them, the law and the gospel, have two different aims. They do two very different things. And while both of them are good, since both of them are from God, they do the work they do is quite different. And therefore, as a congregation or as people, now united to Christ, being able to identify and differentiate between them is of the utmost importance. One, for our own spiritual life and health, but also as a means of growth. How are we going to grow now that we have been joined to the Christ of Scripture? As a church, as a congregation, knowing which sermon, the law or the gospel, is used for which purpose is of very great importance. And mingling those two things or misunderstanding those two things can and has wreaked much havoc in the life of the church. You see, it will determine how we seek to both save sinners, but also how we seek to sanctify them. And oftentimes our approach so mingles things that neither are done with careful precision. You see, confusion here, confusion on these two topics equals confusion everywhere. Trying to use a sledgehammer to do the work of a chisel is a sorely ineffective method and potentially a dangerous business. Well, so too is making wrong use of the law and the gospel as it's applied to our spiritual lives in what will help us and strengthen us. Well, with that in mind, let's just simply answer the question, what is the law? And I want to summarize with this subtitle, Do This and Live. You see, the law, in its basic essence, declares the good. But it declares it. It tells us what is good. It tells us what we ought to do. And then it offers us something for doing it. In its simplest form, it just says, this is the good thing. If you do the good thing, here's the reward for that which you have accomplished. From the day we were born, we have God's law written on us. And what we mean by the law is simply this. God's righteous commandments, or God's own righteousness, what God thinks is good and holy. And those things are imprinted upon us as people made in the image of God, as sons and daughters of Adam. Paul tells us that we have the law written on our hearts. So even if you or I haven't memorized the Ten Commandments, which is a good idea, even if we haven't, if we really don't know the contents of Scripture, even before you were a churchgoer, you somehow knew right and wrong within yourself. There was this basic sense of morality. And what goes along with that is not only is there a basic sense of morality, you don't live up to that basic sense that is implanted in you. This shouldn't surprise us. I mean, we are all children of Adam, our first father. He was made perfectly in the image of God and communicating with God in God's world. He knew all that God required at that point in history. In fact, not only did he know what was required, he was promised that he would receive life, a good end intended by God. He would have great reward if he simply did what God spoke to him. He, as a righteous creature, was to keep all of God's rules, all of the time, all by himself. You know, personally, he was to do it. He couldn't send someone else to obey on his behalf. And if he did that, reward would come for him and his children. Not only was he required to do it, it would be expected of everyone who was born of Adam, you and I. And there was this promise, do what's required and you'll live, and you will live abundantly. Don't, and there would be this threat, you would die, and not only physically, but far beyond. You see, what's fascinating about that old, old story is that whether we know it or not, it's still in effect today. All of us experience this reality. We all know this is true by our own conscience and by our own struggle with right and wrong and how we don't always accomplish what we want to do. We know somehow we're tied to this old story, even if we don't know the names for it. We don't know how to put ourselves there. You see, the law and the righteous requirements thereof are passed down to us all. I mean, you see that in the text this morning. The law, it says in verse 12, is not of faith. Rather, the one who does them shall live by them. What Paul is teaching is that in its purest form, in its original giving, the law offers life, blessing, wholeness based on one's performance. Romans 10:5, for Moses writes about the righteousness that is based on the law, that the person who does the commandments shall live by them. It's not the person who does the commandments will live the commandments. That's a redundancy. He's saying the one who does them will be granted life, will have life by them. He will have reward because of them. The person who obeys, who maintains God's law, who lives uprightly in all of his actions at all times and in all ways, he will live an abundant life. You see, the law, and I want you to hear me here, because the law gets a bad rap, often for the wrong reasons. The law is merely a reflection of God's character. So when you're looking at the law, you're just seeing a reflection of who God is. Paul speaks of the law and he says it is just and holy and righteous and good. Well, who does that sound like? The law is simply God's perfections encased or enshrined in human words. It is a true thing. It is a good thing. And it actually does describe what it means to be happy and fulfilled. If you're wondering why you're not, it's because you don't do these things. I mean, did you hear the psalm that we were singing this morning? That man is blessed who, fearing God, from sin restrains his feet. You know, Psalm 1, if you don't sin, guess what? You will actually be happy. Now, if we don't have happiness, that means there's an alternative route we've taken. I mean, can you imagine how good your life would be if you never lied, if you never envied, if you always loved others as yourself, if lust was never a struggle, if you were never lazy, you just didn't put off those things you know you should do, if you never spoke a harsh word that you regretted and had to do this whole full circle around to try to repair the damage, knowing that even once you've tried to repair it, it will never quite be what it was. Can you imagine just the peace of life you would have if you ever had to answer for wrongdoing? I mean, if you obey the law, Paul says, no one can accuse you of anything. I mean, can you imagine being approached by someone who says to you, hey, do you mind if I talk to you for a second? And your mind doesn't immediately start racing to, oh man, what did I do? I'm sure I'm in trouble for something. That eternal guilty conscience that all of us shares because of our mess that we've created. You see, the problem is not the law. The law is good and holy and just. The problem is simply exposed by the law. The law shows us what the problem is. It's not the problem itself. Paul says in Romans 7, the very commandment that promised life. Notice, the very commandment that promised life, he believes it promises life, became death to me. Well, why? Well, because the law exposes evil. I mean, the law tells the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. The law is not like your spouse and tells you you look good even when you don't. Or that your breath doesn't stink even when it does. The law can't pull those kind of punches. It only tells you what is. And because of that, while it's not the problem, it shines a bright light on the problem and exposes all the loose edges and all the dark spots that exist. You see, it shows us who God is before our face as a mirror. And because it shows us who God is as a mirror, it exposes who we are. And it's not the kind of mirror you find in the dressing room that makes you look two sizes smaller with the lights dimmed and, you know, kind of hazes out everything that you don't like. You see, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the law. It becomes problematic to us insofar as it shows us what the problems are in us. That is what the law does to a sinful man. It screams out one simple fact. You are not holy. You are not what you were created to be. You are not doing what God has required. As far as being made right before God, as far as gaining standing in His sight, as far as gaining life as it was offered from God, the one who does them shall live by them. As far as all that goes, after sin, the law will not help. It will only show you all the holes in your game. I mean, look at the Bible. It's a virtual record of God's demands, followed then by human inability and rebellion in the face of those demands. I mean, even the text we read this morning from Ezekiel, fairly repetitive, but it was definitely shining a light on this point. I mean, reading the Old Testament, Adam has one and only one no in the whole universe. There's only one negative. Just don't do this one thing. Only one simple instruction. And of course, it's the one thing that he runs after, plunging us all into misery. The Exodus story, as soon as God does all of these mighty works in the face of Egypt and before Pharaoh, things that you would think would prove to them the goodness and the power of God. You know, Moses goes away for a few days and they're like, well, we're tired of waiting for this. Just build us a golden calf. Joshua gets in the land, but he doesn't get there before having to deal with issues like Achan and all of the workings of human sin in the midst of the conquest. And once they're finally there, you look, turn the next page from the book of Joshua and you're in Judges, where everyone does what is right in their own eyes. No one follows after God. Because why? There's no king in Israel, so they get a king. And the first thing you notice is that you're just dying that there would be one good king in Israel. Can we just get one that would obey what God has required? And the prophets are almost comical as they warn and warn and threaten and warn. But lo and behold, no matter what they tell the people, change does not come. Even the judgments that come from the law can't change their behavior. You see, the law exposes our sin. And when we turn to the pages of the New Testament, Jesus doesn't lighten load. He doesn't say, oh, you're just misreading the text, you know. God looks at everything with a squint, you know. Or, you know, that was when God was a fundamentalist and now he's changed and he's become far more lighthearted and gregarious. Instead, he intensified our knowledge by showing us the law, those external commandments. Oh, man, they have all kinds of internal requirements as well. You could keep the external law and never kill anybody, and you're still going to be wholly guilty of thou shalt not kill. Because the question of whether you've ever hated someone or been embittered towards somebody, that counts too. Oh, you've never committed adultery? Well, if you've ever lusted after a woman, you've already committed adultery in your heart. He gets into motives and hidden things, things that aren't necessarily seen to the world but are known to God. And he says, those things count as well. Unless you're completely pure there, you will never stand before the face of your Maker. And the worst part is, once the law is known, our judgment is known. If the law shows us all that is needed to please God to inherit the good life, and we see day by day that we're not quite measuring up, then all of us knows, in one way or another, there's going to come a day when the shoe drops and the hammer falls. You see, the law condemns us. As our text says, for all who rely on the works of the law, in verse 10, are under a curse. For it is written, cursed be everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law and do them. So not just those are good rules, I like the rules, but you actually keep the rules. He says, if you don't do that, then you're under a curse. So notice the law shows us the good. It exposes the fact that we're not good. And then it shows us, well, this is what happens to people who aren't good. It condemns us. Well, why is that so important for us to understand? Because we can't understand the importance of the gospel at all, or appreciate its far-reaching significance, or how it's to apply even in our own daily existence, if we don't understand what the law is requiring and the penalty that it will exact for those who do not keep it completely. We cannot know how powerless other forms of trying are if we don't see the issues at stake. We cannot know what sort of things drive us if we don't see that we're always running from the law's effects and trying to operate under its principles. You see, if we think the law is a small thing, then we'll probably keep seeking remedies in just character improvement or just a little, you know, virtue shaping, which are all wonderful things. But if you're trying to use those things to be pleasing to God, you will find it is insufficient and you are not up to the task. You see, if we cheat on the law, we will cheat on grace. The problem at the end of the day is that the law reflects a personal God who is utterly holy. A God who made us, who expects us in this personal way to live up to what he's required all the time, in all circumstances, in every part of our being, for the entirety of our life. No bad days, as the bumper sticker says. In thought, word, and deed. But by what we do and by what we don't do. You see, the holiness of the law doesn't grade on a curve. It doesn't say, just try your best and God will just take care of the rest. It is exacting. It doesn't say your effort, not the outcome, is all that matters. It means what it says. Cursed be everyone who does not abide in all these things and do them. You see, God says as far as right standing before him is concerned, as far as inheriting God and his great reward, as far as the good life is concerned, as far as the new creation or whatever you want to say, it is an all or nothing proposition. You either do what he says in its entirety or you're under the curse. And when we pause for a moment and take inventory of ourselves, the law kills us. Be anxious for nothing. That's a commandment. That's to be obeyed at all times and in every circumstance. How are we doing there? Do not worry about tomorrow. Be thankful in everything, in all circumstances. Let no unwholesome word come out of your mouth. And when you do speak, speak things that are only necessary for the building up of other people. How's that going? Don't ever look at a woman to lust after her. Don't hate your brother. Forgive always. Rejoice always. Consider everyone better than yourself. Is that shoe fitting very well? Be perfect, like God is perfect. You need 100%, and the law keeps score. One of its goals, in fact, is just to get us to all shut up. And that's what Paul says, that every mouth will be stopped before God, that we'll stop with our excuse making, that we'll stop with all of our comebacks. You know how it is in our relationships. Your wife says something and you're at the ready with all the reasons why it's just not your fault or why you had a perfect good reason for doing that, or why it was the circumstances of the day that required you to act like that. It's not who you usually are. Well, when the law comes out and it's seen for what it is, the whole goal is for you just to stop talking and to realize there's nothing left to be said. And the only thing to wait for is the sentence that comes from God and his requirement. You see, if you think you're not so bad, you're using the wrong comparative. We always say, well, I'm not so bad compared to, my brother Joe, who's just a loser. The comparative is God himself. And the question is, well, how are you doing in comparison with God and his holiness? How are you measuring up? Not only does the law expose all of this and say that it's going to condemn us because of it, it offers us no help. It has no help to give us. So you can keep going there for remedy and it will just keep showing you the problem. Any solution that points you back to yourself or what you ought to do isn't going to solve the issue because you are the issue. So going back to your own resources, the resources that are condemning you now, to then say, I'll pull from these, and from these I will make myself pleasing, is a fool's errand. Anything that offers to give you hope in trying or remedy by process is just the law wearing its street clothes. You know, it may not come from the Ten Commandments, but if it's offering you a remedy where you can do something, anything, to where that will get you an inch closer to God and He will be pleased with your actions, that is simply the law in different clothes. Godly people do this. Godly parents train like this. Well, that's all true. All of those things may be true, but they will only to serve to show you the fact that you are indeed not godly. And if you do what you are told to do 10 times, 100 times, if you blow it on the 101st time, then you fail. You see, any form of the law, any ought, any do this that promises that if you do it, you will gain, it may be true, but it will never help you with your problem with regard to God, because it's the voice of the law. An ought with an offer. You see, the reason the law can't help us in this regard, it can't fix us, is that it just doesn't have any power to cover or to heal. You know, maybe remember in Pilgrim's Progress, you know, when Pilgrim loses the book, Moses comes running up the hill and just, you know, beats the living bejabbers out of Pilgrim. And he cries for mercy. And Moses says, I'm the law. I know no mercy. Moses can't come and heal our wounds or bandage us up or set our crooked legs straight. It just doesn't have that power. Paul says, if there had been a law that would have given life, if there would have been a law that could have helped you in this process, then God would have given it. But instead, he had to send his son, which would tell us something. You see, the law is like an X-ray technician. Law serves a wonderful function, just like an X-ray serves a wonderful function. But an X-ray never healed anybody. It just said, there's the problem. What you need at that point is a doctor. What you need at that point is a solution. The picture, the exposure doesn't solve the problem. It just shows us exactly where it lies. Not unlike an injig diagnostic tool. I remember at a point when I was pastoring here formerly, I had a problem with the car. And one of our members, Rob, said, I've got one of those computer scanners. You could just plug it in your car and show you what the problem is. And I immediately thanked him and thought, well, that's neat. And as I was walking away, I thought, I don't know how that's going to help me, actually, because I don't know the first thing about working on a car. If it shows me there's a problem, for instance, in the fuel system, I would have to probably know where the fuel system is for that to give me any sort of help or comfort. You know, it's like someone drowning and you yelling from shore, hey, you're drowning. You know, that's true. Those are all true statements, but it doesn't serve any helpful purpose. And that is what the law does. It shows us here's the problem, but it can't lend a hand to fix it. And what is worse, because of our sinful condition, the law actually excites sin in us. For some weird reason, because of our twisted nature through the fall, we hear a thou shalt not, and then immediately we think, I want to do that. I mean, it's a strange but a real phenomenon. You've probably experienced it. I mean, one of the things I've shared before is that meme that's been passed around online where there's this large pipe, one of these dredging pipes laid out across the sand heading into the ocean. And there's signs every 10 feet or so on the pipe, do not play on pipe. And in the picture, there's just hundreds of kids. And the only place they're playing is on top of the pipe all the way down into the ocean. Well, that's us. The law says this. And Paul says, I wouldn't even known what the problem was. I wouldn't even known what envy was until the law told me not to. And then that's all I wanted to do. Notice Paul says the law is good and holy. It is godlike. And yet it promotes the opposite of what it commands when it runs into a rebellious person. And instead of bringing life, it brings death. No duty, no advice, no amount of coaching, no moral reformation or virtue cultivation will help us in regard to God, because all of those means take for granted that you and I can be part of the solution when we are the entirety of the problem. And until we come to grips with that, there is nothing that can be done. Until you see that you're the ultimate problem that you have before God, there's no help, at least, that we can offer you here. And there's nothing that can help you get right before your Maker. As Augustine says, the law contributes nothing to God's saving act. Through it, he does but show man his weakness. But by faith, he may take refuge in the divine mercy and be healed. So if that's the law, do this and live. I want to say it's the other sermon that God preaches is the gospel, which is a completely different voice. It is something that instead of saying do this and live, says this has been done. Believe. Or this has been done. Now live. Notice what it says in our text in verse 10. Earlier in the scripture, for seeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, in you all the nations shall be blessed. In verse 11, it is evident that no one is justified before God by the law, for the righteous shall live by faith. If the law tells us what we ought to do, the gospel tells us what someone else did. If the law points out our sin, the gospel points away from us and points us to the cross. If the law demands something, you must. The gospel simply promises something. I will. I will do this for you. I will bless you. The law requires that something has to be done, but the gospel offers something that is already accomplished and merely needs to be believed. I want to notice briefly this morning what we will, Lord willing, spend years unpacking. And that is, in our text, Paul makes the following argument. The law says do, but the righteousness that God offers in the gospel says to believe. This is what the core of the issue is, people of God. It has far-reaching implications, not all of which I can get into this morning. But the big question is, how are we made acceptable to God? Today, or any day after today? Once you've been made acceptable to God, how do you stay there? What is it that you have that God says is sufficient to appease what He requires? What do you have that God looks at and says, that's what I was looking for? If at this point you're going through the Rolodex of your mind, considering your best attributes, then I have failed in my purpose this morning. There is nothing, even our best efforts, that don't fall short of God's actual standard. I mean, what is it that we could have done that would ever merit God's kindness? But you see, the gospel gives us permission to look somewhere else with eyes of faith. Instead of going through your own Rolodex, it gives you permission to take your eyes off of you and to cast them away. While the law is exposed to us, while it leaves us naked and wounded before God, the gospel rushes over to cover us, with the righteousness of Christ, to blanket us with His goodness and His actions and His performance. The gospel points us to a man who lived and died and rose again and did it without your knowledge, without your help, and without any permission of yours. And then it says, this is already done and it's gifted to you if you believe. If you want to know what the law of God looks like in action, just look at Jesus. That's all that the law requires. If you've not been like Jesus, then you had better look to the cross, because that is the judgment that the law gives to people who don't live up to God's requirements. And if you want hope, then you should look to the empty tomb, because this Jesus, who lived righteously and died sacrificially, has risen victoriously for all who believe in order to vindicate them, to justify them, to give them a right standing that is not based on their performance, but is based on His. So that anyone, despite their record or lack of effort, despite their pedigree or education or skin color or status, despite what they did 20 years ago that no one knows about or just yesterday, they could look away from themselves and look to Christ and be saved to the uttermost, His life becoming their life. All those actions that He did, God says, yeah, my child did those and counts them as yours. His death becomes your death. The death that is required for what you have actually done. He dies in your stead, and His resurrection becomes yours as a reward for doing all that God has required. Since you are the problem, God offered a solution that has absolutely nothing to do with you. And that is good news. It's available for all who believe. It is sufficient for all who believe and is accepted by God in full. I want to end with this quote this morning. Trust Him, the author writes. And when you have done that, you are living the life of grace. No matter what happens to you in the course of that trusting, no matter how many waverings you have, no matter how many suspicions that you have bought a poke with no pig in it, no matter how much heaviness and sadness your lapses, vices, indispositions and bratty whining may cause you, you believe simply that somebody else, by His death and resurrection, has made it all right. And you just say thank you and then shut up. The whole slop closet full of mildewed performances, which is all you have to offer, is simply your death. It is Jesus who is your life. If He refused to condemn you because your works were rotten, He certainly isn't going to flunk you now because your faith isn't so hot. You can fail utterly, therefore, and still live the life of grace. You can fold up spiritually, morally, or intellectually and still be safe. Because at the very worst, all you can be is dead. And for Him who is the resurrection and the life, that makes you just His cup of tea. You see, Christian, you never get past this. You need this all life long, because all life long, the law is measuring you and you don't measure up. It is the only power to save, and it is the only power to sanctify and to change you. The law, even after salvation, is insufficient to change what's going on in your heart. Any other thing will bring death. It is able to save to the uttermost, not just on the first day, but every single day after that. And that is why it is called good news. May you believe it this morning as we look to Christ for our life. Let us pray.